Okay, we're recording. Hi, Margaret. Thank you for joining me this evening. I'm really excited and happy to have this opportunity to talk with you. This is Nicolette Lodico in New York City. Today is Wednesday, July 15th, 2020. And I'm joined via Zoom conference by Margaret Funkhauser, who I will interview as part of the Oral History Summer School's Education Narratives Initiative. Margaret, will you please introduce yourself and let us know where you're joining this Zoom call from?
Hi, I'm Margaret Funkhauser, and I am in my home in Natick, Massachusetts.
Thank you, Margaret. When did you first become aware of COVID-19? What do you remember about that moment?
I work at a school that is a independent boarding school for the arts, and we have a considerable amount of students from Asia, so it has been on the radar at our school for quite a long time. I remember the first conversation I had directly with a student about it was probably in November of 2019, as they were traveling home for Thanksgiving break or at our school. And then it was definitely a topic of conversation at our school through the holidays and winter break. And into, we run on a semester system, so into the second semester. And I don't think anyone was, the conversations about it were more about support and making sure students, you know, were feeling good about travel. I don't think we had any conversations about, there were no conversations that I was a part of programmatically in terms of how it might affect our school until probably late February or early March.
What were you hearing about COVID at that time, given that news sources here perhaps weren't talking about them?
I think I would say that I was hearing that students, I think it was really surrounding the idea of students had family who were affected, and we didn't have that many students. Our students come from more major metropolises, I don't know how many students, if any, we had from the Wuhan province. So I think it was really checking in with them about relatives, about family. I had one student whose mother had traveled and moved to the area that our school is in. And so this student is from China, but she was a day student at the school. And she was a particular source of information because her mother was quite anxious about it. The student was not anxious about it, but the family was anxious about it. And the way it might both limit travel and the way it's through the student, it was talked about, the mother was quite prescient that it was coming to the United States. And so was leading up to our March break, really thinking about where could they travel, where they would avoid the virus. So I think that the conversation in terms of how it was coming to the United States, I would say probably starting in about February, really ramped up between students, myself and students. Up until then, it was more about checking in with them in terms of, are their families okay? How is this going to affect them. And I would say that they don't want to, I would say that they are not, they were not anxious, and they were not, they were fairly reticent about it. I don't know if they were being cautious in talking about it, or they are teenagers, and so they also, I don't think that it was, they didn't bring drama to this, to the conversation about it.
Can you remember or tell me about the day when your school's leadership addressed COVID-19 officially to students and teachers?
I was tempted before this interview to go back and look through the emails, but my relationship with oral history tells me that I should be more organic in my recollections. My husband is also a teacher and administrator at the school. We both are department heads, and so we are sort of middle management, so we have access to some conversations, but not all the conversations. And we had, there was a moment where we, in our house, probably in late February, his supervisor had said to him, no, not seriously, but not like jokingly, you know, what would it take to move your department online? So we were talking about that at home. And I said, well, maybe at our next department meetings, meaning our separate department meetings, we should ask our faculty, like we should, the word tabletop drill came out of my mouth. I'm not like someone who uses, like, that's not a thing. But I said, maybe we should do tabletop drills and just say to our faculty, because if this is coming, this could be a way to broach the subject before, you know, but I think we both sort of thought of it as a thought experiment and kind of a cool, I mean, if I'm being honest, just because of the way we are as educators, kind of an interesting, cool one, because we have both been, we're both been at the school sort of, we know that as a school, we were behind in terms of online learning, in terms of flipped classrooms, in terms of all the things now, like the tech tools, all the things that are now in hindsight, you know, would have been good to have that toolbox in March. So we did have that conversation in late February, and we both did these meetings in which we said, what to our faculties, let's just do this kind of hypothetical if we had to go online. And I think everyone was a bit skeptical about it at the time. And then during our March break, we got an email from the head of school calling all the department heads together. So that was probably around, I don't know, it was early. It was early. It was about March 10th or 11th, the first week of our break. And then, I mean, the big line for us, for me, and it was when my children's public school sort of, you know, they went to school, they came home, and then they never went back. So I think that is a sort of more of a date that's seared in my mind in terms of, whereas we as a, in the institution that I work for, was, feels a little softer, the road leading up to it.
It's interesting that you were experiencing this in two different ways, at your own school where you teach and with the school where your children go. Can you talk a little bit about the leadership that was exhibited in your school and then the leadership in your kids' school?
Mm-hmm. Well, our school, you know, what I think there was a meeting of, I think it was the administrative team and the department heads and some other key, like the director of student support, probably the director of health, like there's some other people involved where we had this conversation around sort of what needs to be the timeline. I think the decision had been made that students were not coming back, but it was before any kind of schedule structure had taken place. And from what I remember about that conversation in that time, that it was very, not open, but it was very like, it was a Zoom call. So we were all like, what is this Zoom thing? It's so funny. It's so weird. And then this sense of, you know, there was some like, we're going to get through this. We got this. And then it was a lot of just logistics of our students were on spring break. We extended their break by a week to give teachers the, you know, time to get their heads around how they were going to move online. There was a sense of having to figure out and then communicate out program. So there was a real, narratives had to be written. It was fast and furious. I think it felt like the decisions being made were as confident as they could be without, you know, living with all the uncertainty of it. And it was sort of like many things. It was sort of like, we're going to do this till April 10th or something. And then another decision. And I don't think at that point, we really had the sense that like the state of Massachusetts was going to actually be the person calling the shots. Like the school was trying to do the best it could just to keep students and families, not put them in a position where they would have to put their child at risk. That said, we had don't quote me on this, but I think we had about 30 international students who were allowed to stay over spring break who were on campus. And those students actually stayed all the way, many of them stayed all the way through the crisis this spring. And there are still students sheltering in place on our school's campus. It's dwindled down, I think, to about 6 or 7 who actually have graduated, but they are, you know, not traveling back to China right now. So I think that the other thing the school was managing at the time is that they were determined to stay open for the students who could not travel rather than say, you know, you have to find, you have to either travel back to China or find family in the US. So the school is very proud, I think my school is very proud of that decision, that they did that, and that also gave them a roadmap for this fall, because we will open up again this fall if the state lets us. So that is, I think the thing you asked was what did I think about the leadership? I would say that the leadership was making, you know, a sort of like choose your own adventure, you know, or this kind of sense of like, we'll get to this point and then there'll be a kind of fork in the road. They got us through the spring and have made a roadmap to the fall. And so I think that I would say that in terms of leadership, the process for me was very transparent and the decisions were made, you know, weighing a variety of factors. So I don't know if I'm not going to give them a rating because that seems weird, but and I felt supported as a teacher in that situation. I took my own initiative to take that week that we were prepping things. I took a Global Online Academy online class. I don't know why, really. That was actually, that was the professional development for teachers this summer, but something kicked in me that said, like, if I have to teach online, I should take this on, like, this on class for online teaching, and it was free, and I would say that it was a little overwhelming, because there were so many, it was saying, there's so many ways you can do this, there's so many different tools you can use, and I felt like, I just have to like show up and, you know, make sure that the students feel connected. And my children's school, I think similar, there was a kind of like squishy period where we weren't quite sure how it was going to work. And they tried a couple different things out. I don't have anything to compare it to. I feel super grateful for, particularly on the elementary school level, the teachers who really like brought it and felt like they, you know, I, as a dealing with high school students, like being on Zoom, you know, it's sort of like this, like, I feel like it just sucks all the energy and emotion out, especially if you're staring at, you know, a bunch of faces. But I don't think that's anything compared to like, you know, 18 second graders across the screen from you and trying to manage their focus. So I feel really grateful for that. And my other child is in seventh grade. There was, I think, probably a much more passive experience for him. I mean, he had class where he had to be in class, so there was structure, but it was not, did not strike me as particularly interactive, though he claims that that is because that's what class is like in middle school. Anyway, you know, not full of kids raising their hands, you know, sort of voraciously and chatting. But I think we were, you know, I felt like the school district did the best it could with the tools it had, and it worked. It tried very hard to be equitable and provide machines and devices for all the families. Yeah.
What was the first week back to class like? Can you just describe one of those days?
Well, I think I knew right away that the most important thing was to feel like my students stayed connected, to me at the least. And to each other, you know, that was a much more ambitious thing. I mean, I have students who connect to each other outside of class. I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, ways they kept in contact via social media and things like that. But in terms of like the work we do in the class, I think there was some novelty, this sense of like, how's this gonna work? How can we create community. I mean, when I look back on it, I think this right away, just the struggle, but also the kind of energy went into trying to maintain the same kind of community we have in the classroom. That I teach, the department I run is the Writing, Film, and Media Arts Department, and it is has 21 students in it. They work very closely, they work very collaboratively, they tell sort of, it's a lot of, they're a lot of making and process-based work, and then a lot of reflection, and so we are so used to doing that in a room together. So I think that sense of trying to collaborate and process things and connect really hard over Zoom. So that first week, I think it was just trying to get them to stay connected and sort of figure out where opportunities were and where, like, oh, we gotta let that go, you know? So like in my department, we teach film and we teach photography. And so I had students who were going from a darkroom photography class into like whatever that looks like in their own homes and over Zoom. So I think just trying to help translate how the work was gonna, how are we gonna do it? And so that, I remember that. I remember that I had individual, for like the first two or three weeks, I had individual Zoom meetings with, standing meetings with every student in the department. And like the kind of prompt was like, what's good? What do you like about this situation or this mode, or what, where can you find the little joys in it? And then what is hard? And so I think a lot of it was just listening and trying to take that intel and see what I could do. There were things I could control and do. And then there were things I couldn't control or make better, for sure.
What are some of your biggest concerns for your students? And have they changed in the past, well, since the beginning of the crisis until now?
Yes. I think that there were students, I'll start with the good. There were students that thrived, and they were not necessarily the students that were thriving when we were on campus. And that, I think there was something about the self-pacing, the asynchronous work, the like security of their time was their own, the comfort of home, and then like taking the whole, whether they were a boarding student or not, the whole social dynamic piece away. So there were students who felt like they were able to do their best creative work. And some of that came out of simply because, like, if they're in a meeting and they're getting feedback over Zoom, it's just them and the machine. They're not then walking across campus or into the dining hall and navigating all these like social circumstances, where either are stressful and anxiety inducing to them, or the feedback they just got just bottoms out of them, because like, how would they retain it? The machine is right there. So they're getting feedback on their writing, and then they're going right into the process of revision. And so I saw student work just like individually go up, not totally across the board, but like for that sort of the one-on-one piece was really much more significant. And as a teacher, I liked it more as well. But for every student that felt secure in their home and safe in their home, there's a student who doesn't feel secure or safe in their home. And that, you know, at the school that I teach at, we're very lucky because no one gets sent to our school. Like they find the school, they're dragging their parents to us. And, you know, students go away and to boarding schools for different reasons. And some of our students come because the boarding school, the campus, is the safe space. So I think there that, you know, navigating that and not really having, relying on a team of student support to figure out, you know, is the student not coming to class because they are, you know, struggling with something at home, or they're not coming to class because they don't have the systems and structures of a campus and a support team to get them to class. Why is their camera not on? Is it appropriate to ask them to put their camera on? I like definitely much more lean to a kind of sensitivity of, you know, trusting that they, you know, they knew what was right for them in that moment. And that was really hard. It was also hard because I'm away from my colleagues that I work with to support students who are struggling as well. So everything has like four extra steps. Like I get off the Zoom, I'm sending an email, I'm waiting for that email to come back. I'm not seeing my colleagues in the lunchroom. I'm not seeing them in person. So I like described email during COVID as like screaming into the void, you know, because I just felt like, so I think that I had students where they were not thriving. And then, you know, the amplification of that, after, you know, we graduated in right before things came to a head in terms of racial justice. And so I think that, you know, is this kind of reflective moment back on thinking about, as institutions and teachers are sort of reckoning with, I would say, in terms of are we supporting our students of color sufficiently? And the answer is that we're not. That also casts my mind back over, you know, the spring to COVID and the awareness of some issues and the lack of awareness of others. And so I think that, you know, it was like, there was a lot of worry and concern, and then it just felt like, and then the bottom dropped out, and then the bottom dropped out. And so I feel the intersection of those two things. I feel less worried as we move forward and go ahead, because we've sort of had to confront, there was a kind of soft worry for our, I guess if I'm speaking specifically about our students of color, our Black students, there was a kind of soft worry through the spring, and now, it's not sort of in the peripheral or soft. It is right at the center of the work that the school is doing. I don't know if that makes sense. I was like.
Given some of the really significant forces happening outside, for your students, the COVID crisis, the social justice protests and awareness coming to the front. Do you feel that those served as, well, let me ask this. Do you feel that having to move to this online platform, did that cause you to have to reassess and reevaluate the boundaries that you typically have between teacher and student? And then how did these external forces impact that?
I think there's some sort of very surface things that are easy to say about that, which is that, like, I'm in my bedroom right now. And this is where I taught students all spring. Like, my bed is right there. Like, and there, you know, some of them were in their beds. And so that instantly is like a big step.
I'm just going to note the time on that.
I'll keep going. So that instantly causes, you know, things to feel different. And I think it really, I'll speak from the I, you know, I think that it depends on the teacher. I adjusted and adapted to that. That feeling of we're all sort of much more intimate and in each other's private spaces. I was, because of time zone differences, I was Zooming with students early in the morning or late at night, like outside the boundaries of, you know, when I would usually engage with students, they were like, sometimes it would be 10 at night for a student in Asia. You know, it was clear that they were about to go to bed and then we're working on something together. So I definitely blurred those sorts of boundaries. And, you know, I think different people have different ways of describing this kind of crisis response teaching or emergency teaching. And so I think as we head into the fall, the school will have is, you know, we're working towards having clearer boundaries, having not having teachers work from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, things like that. And there, you know, it was really just about, it felt like we were just trying to shepherd students through the spring. And I wouldn't say by any means necessary, but above and beyond, you know, it was like three times as much work. And I saw that in my kids' teachers too, the way they were caretaking. And, you know, it depends. I'm like a much more connective maternal teacher, and so it was not, and I think my students sense that in me, and so it's not as letting my guard down as it might be for a different teacher who's much more formal and but I do think that it was much more those one-on-one meetings I had with students were less about the work or the assignment between us. And they were more, I actually think oral history actually really helped with those, like over Zoom, because it's, you know, it's asking the open-ended question and seeing whether the student, what kind of response you're gonna get from them and what they're, you know, what they're gonna tell you about how they are in that particular moment. So they were much more, those check-ins were much more social and emotional, social, emotional than artistic or academic at times.
How much, excuse me, agency do you have as an educator to make decisions about how you're going to be delivering assignments and working with students?
I have a lot of agency both as a teacher and as a department head. I am, I think, lucky in that way. I work for a private institution that trusts me to build, maintain, and grow program, and trusts that me to manage my faculty. Like there's a lot, I would say, a lot of trust and a lot of freedom. We have recognized that I would say that in the spring, the school just like was like, here's what we do in person. We're just gonna do it online. Like it didn't have, particularly in the arts, which is like a half the program and has components that have theater and dance and visual art and these things, like they were not, the world wasn't prepared for those things to go online. Like at the top level, right? If you read about the performing arts, like they had such a massive, steep learning curve that they're still in the midst of. And then, you know, you can't just transfer a musical or a play online. Like it, you know, that is, people are still working through and inventing new ways to do that, like as we speak. I think going into the fall, there's so much more knowledge about what works and doesn't work and what we can and cannot do, that the school has completely overhauled its schedule. It has completely overhauled the sense of how it uses time. And even though we will be on campus, some quarters are on campus and some quarters are not, it has shrunk the blueprint of how much time students are in the classroom. It has, you know, dealing with density and all kinds of things that have caused it to go, you know, forward 10 years in, you know, 10 weeks or something. That I would say the only constraints that I feel in terms of decision making are the things that the school has sort of constraints that it said that you have to program in these boxes. You are going to have to be able to deliver program to students in California, Massachusetts, Hungary, Russia, and Korea, all, you know, the same equivalent program. You'll have students in the classroom right in front of you, but you'll also have students on Zoom at the same time. Like, so in terms of, I don't think that I feel like I'm not in alignment with those decisions. Like those are, like I, those are the constraints that we're having to kind of work with and under. So I don't feel like, I'm trying to think if there's been a decision that's been made. I mean, our school right now is still grappling and will grapple probably up until like the middle of August about, can it force teachers to go back into the classroom? It was saying, I think up and, you know, even up until today, that yes, you have to go unless you have a pre-existing condition or you're over a certain age. But as we're seeing in the college level, faculty are pushing back on that. So there's no, I'm finding it very hard to like criticize the institution when it's making decisions in, you know, that are based on such an uncertainty that it can't predict. In hindsight, maybe I'll look back and say, oh God, that was not, like, what were they thinking? I think the only other thing I'll say to that is because I had the freedom to design my own, how my program slotted into these constraints, I thought about the impact on faculty quite a bit with how I structured that and the toll that the spring took, and tried to create a schedule and a workload that could deliver the program and give them some breaks and opportunity. Like, I didn't schedule them every day. And I, like, you know, the weeds of that are like, you know, how many preps they have, how many days they have to show up, that, you know, student load, things like that. But, you know, I had to, the students who are, you know, who we serve come first, but I think probably more than ever, I thought about what it would be like to be each faculty member having to go through, whether it's online or in person.
What are you most concerned about when it, with regard to your colleagues?
I'm concerned that it's a lot, like, that it's a lot that they are being asked to do, like, in terms of it's, there's no, you know, to, they have to fully confront that they are designing and building for a new educational space. And also for a new kind of student. I think that the spring changed the students, it changed the teachers, it changed the students. And I am worried about faculty who are just like sort of not facing forward, who are thinking like this will pass and everything will go back to the way it was. I don't believe that, and I think I'm part of a group of people who maybe doesn't want that to be the case. So they're managing, particularly if there's a portion of my department that is sort of squarely rooted in the performing arts. And so this sense of uncertainty, this sense of that, you know, who, you know, a colleague of mine said, I'm preparing kids for a world that doesn't exist at the moment, right? And so these old models or these old, I think we've known for a while, you can't teach the way you were taught. Like you have to be teaching in the now. But that, we don't even know what the now really is. So I'm worried about that. I'm worried about that intersecting with being able to be learners. I would say that the theme of my department, this is that we are all learners right now. And that's easier for some faculty than for others. And I would say that that's not just in terms of teaching online. I think that's in terms of, you know, anti-racism, anti-oppression. Like, I want my faculty to position themselves as learners because I think that might be the way through.
What are some of the key things you've learned? And, you know, which of those do you want to keep and which of those do you want to discard?
Well, one thing that I plan to do that I've never done before is really sort of have my students set their own learning goals. And I think that that is you know, a takeaway from having some training in, you know, the difference between learning in person and learning online and the student-led learning. And, but I think it also is coming out of this, out of the thinking about the ways, particularly because I teach creative writing, this really thinking about the ways to have access and inclusion in the classes, and thinking about how they, what do they value, and helping them understand like their, like, you know, their priorities, their values as learners, and not just saying, you know, you need to learn this because I'm teaching it. But, and I think that I've been heading in that direction for a long time, but this, to very squarely, I think it comes out of these one-on-one meetings of just really like having each student really, you know, articulate what they want to get out of their learning experience this year. And, you know, the whole other jargony thing around that is sort of mastery transcript, which is not something that I fully subscribe to, but this sense of their own, you know, the, holding them accountable for their own learning objectives versus this something that is, comes from some other place or misguided notion. So I think that one, that is something that has come out of this experience for me. I'm lucky because we've always told the students, you know, I work, you know, because the students tell their own stories, you know, they, there aren't, we never tell them what to write about. We never, you know, really tell them how to write something. We're already on that path, but I think in terms of, I really want to know what they care about versus the pre-professional world cares about for them. I'm trying to articulate it, but I think it has to do with the sense that the models are sort of in the, whether that's college or, you know, some sort of, the institutions are crumbling. So if a lot of our framework has been pushing them on a certain path towards institutions, whether that's a place they would submit their writing or films to, or whether that's a university that they want to go to, we're watching those things fall apart. And so in the absence of those kind of questionable, potentially problematic sort of guide stars, what's going to create the path? I think they're going to create the path. So I think that is something I would say that's new and that I'm learning and exploring.
How have you been taking care of yourself and your family over these past several months?
Again, I keep using the word lucky. I feel lucky because my family and I have always sort of traveled as a pack. We're used to spending a lot of time with each other. Up until this past year, we actually lived on the campus of the school I taught at. So my kids grew up in a world of constraint, like their parents had dorm duty and had to, you know, like very institutional sort of family. And I'm glad that we had finally moved off campus for this COVID experience, like that we have our own home. But I think that I feel we like each other. We like spending time with each other. It doesn't mean there aren't moments where we're not driving each other crazy. So I feel grateful for that. In terms of, you know, I'm certainly read a lot about what it's like to have two working parents and have children in the house. But I feel okay about going forward with that. I think there's been such tremendous intel of having to retreat and withdraw from the world. And that is also something I feel good about. Like, I think there was a kind of peace, again, so lucky that it feels that way to me, but a kind of peace and contentment, having a giant global no to sort of people, places, and things out in the world. I know that's, I'm privileged to feel that way. And, you know, like, I'm a writer and I'm a poet, so I like retreat and solitude. I am a poet who likes retreat and solitude. So I guess all that, you know, the quiet is the self-care. It's sort of this imposed. Though I will say that I had just taken up ice skating before the pandemic. And I was really sad not to continue going to the rink. So I'll just put that on the record.
What sources of authority do you follow for getting information about what's going on in the world when you do step out of that solitude and retreat?
Well, in terms of COVID, it's interesting because I think because my husband and I both work for the same institution, we have just kind of latched on to their, we look to them for kind of cues, because I think we spend all this time, you know, bringing our work online, all the labor that went into teaching in the spring. It would be weird to sort of not follow the guidelines of where we work, like, and have like this dual life where we're like, here we are, you know, in this very rigid, we're not, you know, there was a period of time where we weren't allowed on campus, is like half a mile from our house, but we couldn't go to our office, like the campus was on lockdown. And so that is a kind of authority saying this is how to behave. And so it would be weird to be like a Yahoo who's like then like out in the world, you know, ignoring all those strictures. We wouldn't have done that anyway, but it, you know, I think you to exactly, like, you look to an authority to tell you how to be. So we just looked actually to the school that we work for. And I think we have to continue to do that because they're going to put travel restrictions on us if we're going back into the classroom. So between that and I would say, you know, I look to, I read the Boston Globe to find out things that are going on in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, I think that there's a certain amount of just instinct. I found that, you know, again, with the values, like, you sort of start to see where your values align or don't align. I guess one other anecdote to share about that is that when the protests started happening, I was a kind of breaking point for me in terms of isolation. And I had up until then been quite content I was in no rush to go anywhere or do anything, but watching that through, you know, that news cycle and watching it through the feed, I started to worry about my own sort of phobia of going outside, because I felt so activated to protest, but then so constrained by my own, you know, I joked that I was going to be the person in the bomb shelter who came up 15 years later and didn't know that, like, the nuclear winter had passed. So I broke the seal by going to a protest, which was like, I hadn't been to the grocery store. It was the first time I was out in the world. And there I was, like, hundreds of people around me. And I think that that sense of where do you get your information from, or where are you taking your cues from, or what sort of authority are you trusting? I felt like being out with people after being so afraid to be out was like it was very cathartic, and it really caused me to think how, for me, like how, how isolated and how removed from community I was.
So this project has a social aspect built into it and a cohort. What are the types of things that you would like to learn from them as part of this project?
So based on what we just talked about, I think to not feel isolated, I think very specifically and locally, I keep coming back to this, but how do you build community online? Like, create connection through apart? I think that would be, because I think as a facilitator and a leader, I do that, but I don't have a great understanding of what it's to be like on the other side of that. And so I guess, most of the people I Zoom with are like my colleagues. So, you know, I think it could be like, it could to create connection would be important. I would say, it will be very interesting. Oh, that's not the right word. It will be very, teachers going back into the classrooms and what that's like, I think, and the ways, people are holding their institutions accountable for their safety and supporting teachers in that, who are in that situation. If it comes to that, my husband and I talk about that we're doing all this work to get back into the classroom and then probably end up back online, but I don't know. I guess my other thought is that sense of how is teaching changing, particularly that student agency piece, because that's a piece I'm thinking about a lot. And Gen Z, what do they need?
Thank you.
Well, I have one more thing with that, which is families. The families of the students, like, and the relationship between a learner online, and the family the partnership between teachers and families.
We're at 1 hour. Do you have a few more moments? A few more minutes for a few more questions? Wonderful. Could you talk a little bit about the path you took to your own career in education?
Sure. Sort of when I was very young, sort of primally, like, I was like, when, you know, I played teacher. That was like one of my earliest memories, was doing that. I don't know why. And then in college, I actually studied dance. And I was much more interested in choreography and teaching. And then after college, I transitioned, I guess, creatively from dance to poetry. And then again, when I got myself into grad school and the path forked, I chose to teach it more than to, like, I write it, but I don't, I would say that I, for a variety of reasons, prioritize teaching over making. And still exploring why I did that, but teaching's really challenging for me. I sometimes think I do it because it's hard, which is I've been thinking about that a lot recently. And so yeah, and then high school versus college, I used to teach on the college level, and I think that there was something about meaning. I needed it to mean more, I guess, and be less about me. So I think that that was part of it. I feel super lucky because I teach where I teach functions like a college. I get to teach like creative, I teach on the arts side, but it's very quite serious programmatically. My students select into like a major and half of their curriculum. And I get to identify like as a poet without that being fraught somehow. I might be at the end of my time as an administrator by choice. That is something I've been thinking about quite deeply starting this spring. And so that's sort of where I'm at on a career path. Partly because I really feel like at my school, there's not a system in place for like rotating leadership. And I think I deeply believe that leadership should rotate. I don't enjoy administrative work, but also I feel like other people should have the opportunity to lead.
Is there anything else that you would like to share, even if it's just something that you want to remember about these past several months?
Well, one thing that you brought up that I sort of on my mind right now is that I think when I was a younger teacher, I was much more, I don't know if it was that I was willing or I just like younger teachers are much more naturally like allow themselves to be vulnerable or cross boundaries in terms of, you know, connecting with students. And I would say as a teacher, while I don't think I'm formal, I think that I guess as an institution, you know, this sense that you sort of have to kind of draw a line between you and the student, in terms of like formality. And there, you know, I could go into, you know, particularly why institutions have swung that way. I think particularly independent boarding schools have swung that way for good reasons. Like they do not want blurred boundaries between adults and students. It is hard to support students socially and emotionally sometimes because you are being quite, you're sort of being quite sensitive to those boundaries. And I do think that that is an area of growth right now, at least where I work, of how do you connect and support and listen and you know, empathize and, you know, also and communicate, like just quite honestly, like communicating with my students over email is like the worst. And so like, how do you reach out into the world and forge like a line of communication? And so I think that, I guess I want to remember that that's a sticky thing right now, to really, to be earnest and honest and open in your support of your students and feel like, you know, you are also teaching them, you know, that there are edges and boundaries, you know, in their lives and with the people in their lives. So I think that might be sort of where there's not a lot of professional development out in the world about that for high school teachers. And I think in terms of particularly supporting, you know, Black, Indigenous, students of color, all the training says that you need to be more vulnerable. And then when institutions are telling you to not be vulnerable. So I guess that's the, like, my brain is there in terms of, I don't know, the thing to kind of remember in this moment.
Thank you. Well, stop recording now, if that's okay with you.